You are listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. This episode was recorded in Nairobi as part of a series of episodes we're bringing you from East Africa to explore identity and architecture. Identity is the theme of this year's LFA.
Well, I actually have very vivid memories of going into town, the Central Business District, with the old 50s, 60s buildings, fairly tropical modernist. And I remember being quite wowed by that, because it was, you know, it's quite different from the traditional houses we would encounter. The city was quite a unique place. Yeah. I'll probably say the steepest learning curve in my life was while working at 3D Read, because it was quite a strong commercial practice, but had also a good design sense, you know, with research-led principles in terms of how to approach problems in architecture.
You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
Stella Motegi, one of the co-founders of Cave Limited.
Kabage Karanja, another co-founder of Cave. Yeah.
On the programme this week, we speak to the architects Kabage Karanja and Stella Motegi, two of the three founding directors of Cave Bureau in Nairobi. Kabage was born in Kenya and later studied in the UK, in Loughborough, then in Brighton, and finally at the University of Westminster. He subsequently spent 6 years working for 3D Read in London, before returning to Nairobi. Stella, meanwhile, studied at the University of Newcastle, near Sydney, in Australia, before returning to Kenya, where she worked for a number of practices, before ending up in the same firm as Kabage. Some years later, they were both made redundant from the same firm, which spurred their founding of Cave. The practice they founded with longtime friend Balmoyabe in 2014 draws much of its reference from the cave, mankind's earliest architectural environment. Much of their work too references the region's status as the cradle of humanity. The city, they say, like the caves, are dynamic and complex, having both changed over time, albeit with varying geological timescales. The name Cave Bureau harks back to man's fundamental need for shelter, which perhaps explains much of the firm's work in places like Kibera, Nairobi's largest informal settlement, or slum, where they're currently working on a school. Cave Bureau's beautiful office cum art gallery, which they call The Cave, is in the Kilimani neighbourhood, just west of downtown Nairobi. I joined Stella and Kabage in a shared meeting room just above their office. The office's beautiful polished concrete walls proved too acoustically taxing for this podcast's array of microphones. I started by asking Kabage about the founding of Cave Bureau.
So three of you, I understand, founded Cave. How long ago?
2014 was the year. Okay. After an interesting episode, both Stella and I were fired. I always promise I'll never say that.
Okay. From the same firm?
Same one.
Fired for the same thing or fired for... when you say fired, you know, made redundant is one word, but was it a redundancy or a...
Yeah, to be honest, it's more like a redundancy, but I like the sort of street cred
of being
street
fired.
Cred of being fired, because it sort of is, isn't it?
You have to make a story about how you're fired for doing something really outrageous architecturally. And exactly. So you were both working for a bigger practice.
That's right.
Were you then?
That's right.
Yes.
And decided. So you both How did you meet? The three of you, but the two of you, how did you?
So with Balmoy, I met him growing up, basically. We would cycle and interact between different schools.
Okay.
Stella, I met at the practice.
Okay.
The big office.
Yeah. So you were born born in Nairobi?
In Nairobi. Okay. Most of my high school in Nairobi. And then, yeah.
I mean, I'm interested then. So you studied university here? Where did you go to uni?
Went to uni in the UK. Started off in Loughborough with the foundation course in art and design.
Yeah, okay.
And then went to Brighton for my undergrad.
Right.
Then straight after that went to London to do my postgrad, RIBA.
Where was that?
Westminster University.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know Westminster well.
Yeah, I do.
Schools in there. But what led you then, growing up in Kenya, what led you to the UK? What led you into doing architecture?
It's a good question. I didn't necessarily want to be an architect because I didn't know what it was.
Right.
You know, it's something your parents tell you you should do. It's a great thing to do, but you don't really understand it.
So I'm not sure actually in the UK whether people's parents, certainly people's parents who aren't architects, they tell them to be doctors and lawyers and accountants, but maybe in the UK people's parents don't generally tell them to be architects. But architecture, speaking to people here, seems to be more respected as a professional discipline. Do you think that's
true? Yeah. And we sort of have a weird thing where, as you'd call it, doctor, you know, doctor so-and-so, we have a weird thing where we say architect so-and-so, engineer so-and-so, which I find really weird.
Yeah.
But it's something that's
strange.
So just to answer that point, it's like, it's like an equilibrium between all professions.
Okay.
Architecture is quite, it's up there.
Yeah. So you were persuaded, you were kind of parents, there was some influence there, was there?
There was some, but initially there was an interest. Yeah. And I think that's what led in the slight persuasion, interest in structures, in buildings. Things.
Okay.
You know.
And then I kind of interested you, the legacy of buildings, I guess, in Nairobi, which you would have been exposed to as a child.
Yes.
Is a particular kind of reference, I guess, from a UK influence, maybe some of the buildings, some of the older buildings, but how did that kind of affect the...
Well, I actually have very vivid memories of going into town, the Central Business District, with the old 50s, 60s buildings, fairly tropical, modernist. And I remember being quite wowed by that.
Okay.
Because it was... You know, it's quite different
from
the traditional houses you might, we would encounter.
Yeah.
The city was quite a unique place.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so we might come on to the kind of university education then in the UK. You were born in Kenya?
Yes.
Born in Nairobi?
Born and raised in Nairobi, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where did you go to architecture school?
I went to Australia. Yes, I was in the University of Newcastle.
Okay.
So after my high school here in Nairobi, I went to Newcastle in Australia.
To study architecture?
Yes, to study architecture.
And same question again then, really, I guess. What kind of, how did you get into the profession?
I sometimes try to wonder where it came from, but I think I might have had influence from my dad, who worked with a female architect. He'd never met a female architect before, and this was when I was in high school, so it was quite rare to find a female architect in Kenya.
Yeah.
And I think he was very fascinated by that, and he would keep telling me about her.
Right.
And
do you remember her name? Do you remember?
Yes, Joy Mboya.
Okay.
No, is it Joy? Joy Mboya.
Yeah.
It was Joy Mboya. But I don't think she practices architecture anymore.
But she still calls herself an architect.
Yeah, that's who he encountered. And I think he was extremely fascinated by a lady.
making buildings.
Yeah. And in charge of the design team, so telling the engineer what to do and, you know, the client, this is what you should do. And they were all men.
Right.
So, I mean, coming from an older traditional African man,
yeah,
I think that really fascinated him. And so he started talking a lot about architecture to me. So I guess somehow subconsciously.
Yeah. But quite, I guess for his generation, quite a kind of bold move to push his daughter into a more male-dominated profession, maybe.
Yes. Which was, well, he wasn't that, I would say, traditional African man.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a big thing for him push me to do something different. And then I guess also subconsciously trying to find out more about architecture. Yeah. The high school I was in, everybody would do pharmacy or medicine or a lawyer, never architecture. So, and then when I found out from people, there was very few girls at that time doing architecture. So I was like, why not?
Yeah.
I can do it.
So why not then? You know, what led you to think, actually, I'm not going to go to the University of Nairobi. I want to go to Australia to study architecture.
Again, my dad. Yeah. I did the Kenyan system of education.
Okay.
And finished high school when I was 17. And a few years, I don't remember when the 844 system was changed from the old one where we did A-levels.
Yeah.
So A-levels was no longer part of what the education system was. But it was very important for my dad that you have to do your A-levels before you go to university, because according to him, that's where you grow up.
Right.
You can't go to university
until you've grown up.
Yes, straight from the O levels.
Right.
So for him, A levels was very important.
Okay.
So after my O levels in the Kenyan system, I had to do the A levels, and then because of that,
you studied. What did you study at A level? What were your?
I did math, geography, and economics.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a bit, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Quite scientific, maybe, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But the geography, you can see that kind of influence there.
Yeah. I should have done art, but I didn't do art in O-levels.
Okay.
So didn't do art in A-levels either. But yeah, so because then while doing the A-levels, I couldn't get into then the Kenyan university, so because
they
people
wanted art, did they?
No. The people that I had finished O levels with during the 2-year break had already gone into university.
Okay.
Yeah, and so we looked for universities abroad. I think Australia, the Olympics were going to be in Sydney.
Okay.
So that was also a
big
influence.
Kind of architectural focus again, as there always is on the Olympics, I guess, and a big kind of buzz around Australia.
Yeah, because actually even the universities that responded and accepted my application, my decision on which one to go to was largely based on where the Olympics were going to be. So okay. Newcastle it was, which was 2 hours away from Sydney.
Okay. Mm. And a big school, I mean, I don't know a huge amount about the architectural education in Sydney. Is it, different schools have different, we'll come on to sort of Westminster in a minute, but different schools are known for different things. Was there a kind of specialism or a kind of style that came out of Newcastle?
It was very design-based rather than, because there are schools that are very heavy on structure and how does this building stand rather than design.
Yeah.
And so University of Newcastle was very design based.
Okay.
And they had this thing they called problem based learning.
Okay.
So we didn't even do exams.
Right.
I never did any exam while at uni. So it was always just continuous assessments and largely based on your design capability.
Okay.
Yeah. So design was a large part of that.
Okay.
Mm.
And then, so that's a 3-year course, 4-year course in Australia? Did you then go on to do a master's there?
It was 2 degrees, actually. So 3 years and then 2 years.
Okay.
And with that, between the 2 degrees, you could take a break.
Okay.
So it's a 5-year program. Mm. And I took a break, came back home and worked for 2 years.
And in a practice?
Yes.
Okay.
And then went back. It was meant to be 1 year.
Okay.
And my visa after the first year took a bit long to process. Right. So when it was finally processed, the uni said you're a bit late.
Yeah, you're going to
so
miss out.
So don't come.
Okay. Come next year.
Yeah. So,
so you worked for 2 years in do you remember the name of the practice?
Yes. What was it was called Dimensions.
Okay.
Yeah, Dimensions Architects. Oh, okay. And even after I finished, I came back and worked and there.
What sort of work were you doing then as a architectural assistant on...
Yes, I had a really good boss who would who'd throw me in the deep end, okay. So to say.
Not
so
good experience.
Yeah, yeah, so I wasn't your typical intern. Yeah. He'd let me design and would just go briefly through my design, and he'd make changes where they need to be. Yeah. But largely, he let me do...
A lot of freedom to come up with.
Yes, okay. And you know, sometimes he'd... like, I was involved in the Brookhouse School design. And he would let me go and run meetings. And I was fresh from uni, and here you are, small little girl, in a room full of old men, and you're telling them what to do. So, yeah, he was very good.
Enjoyed that as a challenge, did you?
It was very scary, because then sometimes they would ask you a question, and you're like, I don't know the answer to that. But yeah, it was good. It was a good challenge. Yeah. It made me feel very important, one, that I was the boss in the meeting, or that I'm the one who would make the decisions and run past him. But he would come once in a while just to make check. Sure things were going well. Yeah, but that's how he taught me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then 2 years back in Australia doing the master's.
Mm.
Back to Kenya then?
Yes, back to Kenya. I did try to get a job in Australia, but it was very hard.
Yeah.
It was very hard, which was strange because my classmates got jobs very easily. Right. So I don't know what that was.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't want to give it a name. But
but a challenge,
Yeah, okay. So... and. For me, it was important because a lot of, I don't know if you've come across it, a lot of students that come from Africa, it's so important for them to remain out there rather than come back home. So they'll do anything to like get citizenship or permanent residency or something like that. Just like a safe haven so that if they come home and things don't work out, I can always go back. But and then they end up changing their courses
In order to stay somewhere.
Yeah. Right. And I know like to get there's like some sort of marks system in Australia. If you did a certain course, you got certain marks, and the marks ended up with how easy it was to get permanent residency.
Okay.
So you'd find people, you know, you studied law and then you go and do nothing because nothing has higher points. but for me, it was important to practice architecture. That's what I studied. And so I came back home.
Yeah,
I came back home.
And then worked, was did you then first job in the bigger practice?
I went back to Dimensions. Okay. Yeah, I went back to Dimensions, worked for a while and then left. My husband is a fit-out contractor.
Right.
And he does a lot of design build.
Yeah.
So there was a period he was getting very busy.
Yeah.
I was not very happy at work.
Yeah.
So I left to join him, but it didn't last because then the bigger firm, someone there knew that I had left.
Yeah.
So they looked for me.
Okay, headhunted.
And
yeah,
I ditched my husband and he was not paying me enough.
No, okay. But ditched only professionally at the
time.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Still your husband. Still
your
husband.
Yes. I ditched his job.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And then working in the bigger firm, so we'll come on to the bigger firm in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Kabadje, your route then into the UK, studying, again, there's a kind of an interest maybe in some of the British buildings, you might call them British buildings, you're kind of exposed to here.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a change moving to the UK to study architecture? What was the
I guess it was.
Kind of first impression of moving to London and moving?
So when I first moved to the UK, I went to Loughborough,
Yeah.
Okay. which is a bit of a small town,
Yeah.
you know,
cold.
You commute
presumably.
Through London.
Yeah.
Past the bus.
Yeah.
And get to this sleepy university town.
Right.
Which was great, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was that contrast. And London, I only experienced to the latter end of my architectural education.
Back to the masters. Okay.
And yeah.
And again, we were talking earlier then about Newcastle. Is there something about the architectural? Is Loughborough known for a particular thing? You know, what's the kind of style of teaching at Loughborough? How do people?
So Loughborough, I did a foundation course in art and design. I mean, throughout my life, I love to draw. I mean, I would paint a lot. In contrast to Stella, for my A levels, I did art throughout. And I went into the foundation course not knowing that I wanted to do architecture. So it's
You've
only
come from
towards
a,
the
a
end.
Very different route, really, to Stella, then, in terms of your...
Yes, quite different, actually. And it was only towards the end of that foundation year that I realized, maybe I should try it out. So I applied for an interior architectural course at Brighton University. A bit confused if I had that capacity to be an architect. My strengths were not in the maths and physics, which is probably Stella's strengths.
Okay.
So I went in not feeling like I had that capacity. Yeah. So it was only in the interview when the dean who was interviewing at that time, which was really strange, Anne Boddington, I remember her name. she just said, yeah, if you want to practice architecture, you can do it. You have the hand.
Right.
And so she's the one who probably gave me the push,
and confidence,
the confidence as well, to jump and give it a go. And yeah, the rest is history in a way.
But an interesting history. I mean, that's what we're... Mm. So you then, after Brighton, then moved to London.
To London.
For University of Westminster for the Masters. And then you'd been to London a few times by that point.
Yeah.
And it was straight then from Brighton to London. You didn't practice in between.
So after my undergraduate, my tutors hired me to do some work. And they worked in London, in Dulwich.
Right. Okay.
And so I was helping. So I was helping them
with
some research projects they were doing in the south of London.
Do you remember the name of their firm? Do you remember what they
were? BNV, Bon and Vullion.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you're doing sort of more research work than kind of practical kind of constructional design?
Yeah, predominantly research, although they were doing a number of renovations for some Victorian houses, so we helped with that.
Okay.
So there was that research side and that sort of real world stuff,
But on kind of British buildings, then you were real British buildings in Britain.
That classic Victorian.
Yeah, okay, different style from, And then after Westminster, did you think about staying? Did you think about?
I stayed, because
as
soon as I finished Westminster, I got a job at 3D Reed in London. And spent about 6 years working that practice. They are pretty big.
Yeah.
I would probably say the steepest learning curve in my life was while working at 3D Reed, because it was quite a strong commercial practice, but had also a good design sense, you know, with research-led principles in terms of how to approach problems in architecture. So it was a good time. And in the heart of London, it was a great experience.
Yeah. So 6 years, say, at 3D Reed.
Yeah.
And what was the kind of thing in the back of your mind then that led you to think, I've had enough of this? People talk about a seven-year itch. Was it a six-year itch? You decided it's time to move. What was the...
It wasn't a difficult decision to make. I think with my family a very strong connection to Kenya, and it's such a fresh market, allowing you to really sort of stretch your thinking and able to challenge how to practice architecture.
Right.
So that for me was a pull from a very, very early time, you know. And yeah, eventually just decided to pack up and leave. Right.
But you packed up and left without a job or a firm to come back to, did you?
I left with an offer, right. Okay. But it wasn't a guaranteed offer. So I just came in.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was the firm that I met, okay. Stella.
Yeah.
Where we were fired.
Where we were fired.
So a big, what, I mean, you may not want to say the name, I don't know what was the, yeah. So a big, biggish practice in Kenya.
Yeah.
And you were doing what sort of work together? What was the kind of bread and butter of the work?
I would say they were very, very commercially driven. They might have been partly challenged on the design end.
Yeah.
Although their history in terms of design
yeah.
is very strong.
Mm.
Okay. Their capacity to deliver thoughtful projects.
Yeah.
And maybe you could argue over time that began to wear out.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you sort of work together? Did you, I mean, how was that kind of, you must have both, this idea of cave must have started to gel in your mind somewhere that you might want to leave and to set up by, because it's quite a bold thing to do when you're employed by a practice and you get a salary at the end of the month. And you, I suppose being, is it, was the idea there before you, say you were fired, you know, was that kind of an idea bubbling away that you might want to do your own thing, or was it circumstance or kind of situation that...
It was there, but an idea that you toy around with.
Yeah.
And what you begin to realize that you didn't really think it through.
Right.
If it happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's extremely daunting, as with all SME startups. You know, it's something that was at least in my mind. I don't know about Stella, if you had it in mind.
I think I was... I worked there for 7 years.
Right.
So I was getting to, as you say, the 7 year age, and I was getting very tired of doing the same thing over and over.
Yeah.
Which is the card monkey.
Yeah.
Talking
the
about.
Card monkey. Yeah.
I'd become a card monkey actually, and I'd talked to their management a lot about new challenges, new position at work.
Yeah.
But it was, I don't know whether it was politics or something was going on, but I just kept at the same stage, but still being given a lot more responsibility, but not being matched with, you know, what the same people in the same firm were doing. I called something different, they aren't different.
Right.
But anyway, so I was at a point where I was beginning to get a little tired of going to work there. But then, you know, you get a salary every month.
Yeah, it's hard.
Which is a nice thing.
Some
so
security.
Actually making a decision to leave is very hard. It's, you procrastinate about it for a very long time. So when I was called to be... they were letting us go, actually. Yeah. We weren't really fired.
it's funny, there's often that euphemism, being let go. You know, people often use that as a term rather than being made redundant or being, it's just an interesting kind of language thing about being let go. But made redundant, was that it was a commercial decision?
It was a financial decision for the company.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I remember, keep telling this story when my boss was trying to tell me that they're letting me go, being made redundant.
Yeah,
it was so difficult for him to tell me because at the time, I was in charge of the project where the office was moving into.
Right.
Yeah, so I was the one coordinating everything, and we'd moved into a sort of semi-finished building.
Yeah.
But I'm the one everybody would come to, where are these cabinets going? Yeah. Where had you designed this for? Yeah. Where are these desks going? And where does everybody sit?
Yeah.
And then actually the day after we moved is when he called me to the office and yeah. told me they had to let me go. And he began by telling me about a sample door that had been done that was not... this was for another project yeah. that I was running on site, and the contractor had made a sample door for approval.
Right.
He'd
right.
not manufactured them, but he kept going on and on about how terrible the sample door was.
Right. Trying, do you think, to find a...
Yeah, and so reason. At some point I asked him, oh, so are you letting me go because of a sample door?
Yeah.
And then, you know, it must have dawned to him, what am I saying?
Yeah.
Because that's literally what it was, a sample.
Yeah.
And you correct a sample. Yeah. Anyway, and then, yeah, that was funny. And then he's like, no, it's because, you know, we're going through financial blah, yeah. blah, blah. Yeah.
And was that, what year was that? When did you both leave?
2014.
And was there a wider kind of downturn in the construction industry at the time, or was that particular for the firm? Do you remember? Because people, it's interesting, I've spoken to a few people who have talked about construction cycles linked to election cycles a little bit, and investment kind of being pulled back before elections. But this wasn't kind of a general cyclical thing, it was a...
Well, in 2013, there was the general election.
Right.
Yeah.
So you might have argued that that resulted in the downturn.
Okay.
Where the firm had to sort of relook at all systems.
Yeah.
And see if things are okay.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you've both been told, was your story about being let go a similar? Were you given a sample or a door handle that wasn't right? How were you told?
No, it was a financial thing.
Okay, so you were given the kind of honest answer slightly more. Yeah. Than you were. And then did you talk previously? Did you both think, actually, like, we've been pushed, now's our chance to do what we've always wanted? You were presumably being unhappy at the cab monkey style of working, were you? Was that... going on in the back of your mind?
Well, for me, it wasn't the cad monkey thing. I actually wanted to leave in about a year's time.
Right.
So they sort of pushed me
gave
out.
You a jump start.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's quite an interesting difference of how we left and what state of mind.
Yeah.
And we knew each other.
At the same time.
It was at the same time.
And then you talk to each other, did you what was their kind of right, now's our chance, you thought? Well,
yeah, there was a group of us, actually. It wasn't just us two.
Five. Okay. Six.
About six of us.
Yeah, right. We're six of us. So and we're given a month's notice.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
For so a whole month.
It's not a long time though, a month, is it? You know, people are sometimes get a bit
But
so you had that time, you were finishing off the handing over projects and having a discussion between you. And where did Balmoy come in?
I'd been chatting with Balmoy for a long time because, as I mentioned, we were good friends.
Okay.
Yeah. So as soon as I exited, we just started chatting.
Yeah.
And between the time that Stella and Balmoy and us, just when we came together, I was working on smaller jobs.
Okay.
But realized very fast the sort of importance of having a team.
Yeah.
And at that point, I think we first started the conversation with Balmoy, then Stella was roped in, and it just made sense to do this daring thing, set up an office.
Which was initially then the three of you as an office.
Yeah.
And did you start, as a lot of people do, and maybe in London, starting work from your front room, from your bedroom? Was so you started?
Yeah, we sort of satellited, each in their own apartment or house, doing stuff.
Okay.
Meeting
once in a while.
And how did you start office? Then you didn't take it, so sometimes when people leave a firm they end up actually some clients going with them.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have a client base to start with, you just had to go out straight away and find your own clients
sort of, but we've had some followers in fact one of our projects is a client that has followed us.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
Which is a good sign.
Yeah.
You do something right.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yeah, we didn't start with any project per se.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you made a decision then to start going out to look for work.
For work.
Yeah.
And what was the sort of start? Was there a decision about what sort of work you were going to pursue, or was it just a case of we need work, we'll take whatever we can get? Yeah, we need to
Need to get some money coming in.
Yeah, there was that.
Yeah.
But we also had values.
Yeah.
We, you know, being in Nairobi and Kenya, a lot of systems are compromised by corruption.
Right.
A lot of processes of tendering jobs and, you know.
Of winning work.
Winning work.
Yeah.
We categorically didn't want to be part of that because we felt, for one, morally it's wrong,
yeah,
but also it compromises the architecture itself.
Mm. Mm.
So based on that, we had weeded out, first of all, public work, and also very selective with the clients.
Yeah.
So we made our work even harder, yeah, to some extent. Trying to take yeah, a sort of moral high ground.
Because the public sector is a large procurer
huge.
Of, and yes, you had immediately decided
yeah,
that was a avenue of work that was not for you.
At least for the time being.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Till it's cleaned up.
Yeah, that's a bold, yeah. Bold, brave might be the word, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So that leaves then the private sector, more of the private sector.
Yes.
That's right.
And I guess then, there's residential work, there's commercial work, there's kind of cultural work. What was the kind of focus that you wanted to?
It was hard because, as we said earlier, we were sort of winging it, looking for clients yeah, where we could find them. And probably one of our first projects we got was a speculative master plan for an agri-village in Somalia.
Right.
And it was quite a random encounter. But this Somali director of a foundation came to us saying that they are seeking
funding
really
yeah,
for the project, and they need a sort of holistic master plan
mm,
to demonstrate what the project's about. And yeah, that was one of the first projects where we really worked together and sort of
yeah,
pulled our, you know, hair out, staying in late,
yeah,
questioning what
yeah,
the ideas were.
But there was funding, I mean, for a speculative project then, there was funding.
There was some funding, yeah.
Yeah, so you paid for a master plan.
Yes, yes. Although very minimally. Small,
yeah,
effort, yeah,
yeah, that's yeah, a couple of small jobs. Yeah.
As with small offices,
yeah,
we,
yeah,
we get to be shortchanged sometimes.
Yeah. But you start getting work on the books then,
yeah,
and start
yeah,
demonstrating.
Yeah.
But starting out with a master plan is mm, maybe unusual. People may be starting with small
yeah,
residential projects and
yeah,
building up in scale. Do you remember the kind of next kind of mm, tranche of work that came in? What was the?
So there was a school in Kibera.
Okay.
Which
is in Western Kenya.
No, it's in Nairobi.
Oh, okay. One of the
it's
districts.
One of
okay,
the biggest slums in Africa.
Right,
Kibera. Mm.
I mean, there's an estimate of between 700 to a million people that live within an extremely
okay,
small site. So this NGO
yeah,
that's involved in producing schools and clinics
okay,
in Madare and Kibera came to us, you know, and requested that we, you know, look at a design for a school, a girls' school specifically.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting one because we collaborated with a Spanish architect.
Right.
Who came to us looking to collaborate.
Okay.
Mm.
And that yeah, that was one of the other projects that
okay, and that
gave off. Yeah.
That's been built.
Yes,
that's been built.
That's
yeah,
been built.
Yes.
Okay.
It's actually built, the biggest structure in the slum.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then what's the kind of interested in people's response to buildings in slum areas, you know, in terms of kind of pride in buildings, pride in their environment, that wherever people live, people want to have pride in their environment. What's the kind of, for you as architects, the process of talking to people about the sort of building they want? And
It's a complex process.
Yeah.
A process that fortunately had been preempted or partly done by the client
right,
who are very engaged with the community.
Yeah.
So at the point of entry, we already had a lot of the groundwork done.
Mm-hmm.
So when you speak to community members, they already know what they want.
Yeah.
You know, and the client is facilitating that project and you assisting them in that process.
Okay.
So that,
so it's
that
an engaged,
was quite good.
I mean, what's quite interesting then is a really engaged client, not someone who says, design a school, come back when it's done.
We'll figure it out if it works or doesn't. You know.
Yeah, so they were very involved. They were in the design, and they knew exactly what they wanted.
Right.
And I guess one of the things was correcting what they had, because they already had the existing school.
Right.
But the girls were getting a lot more, so they needed to bigger building.
Right. Mm.
So they already knew what is lacking and what is needed. So it was easy for us during the design process.
Because sometimes people talk about clients knowing what they want, and actually clients knowing what they want is sometimes not what they want at all. And kind of, but
very often.
Yeah. But this was a client who really did know and were kind of educated and were really kind of, right, okay.
Because they had been burnt.
Yeah.
They had a whole building that been semi-designed, built, but then soon condemned.
Yeah.
Right. So to date it's been demolished. And
that was because the contractors, was it?
We're not very sure, 100%, where the sort of blame lied, per se. Right. But yes, definitely there was the workmanship in the structure. Okay. That was a big failure.
Yeah.
So they had gone through a slight learning process
to
appreciate the services of an architect who would lean the process, you know.
Yeah, and would oversee the construction.
That's right.
And would get...
That's right.
So that was one of the early projects of CAVE. Was that just the three of you then still? There comes a point in a practice's evolution where you go from being the three directors to then having to employ someone yourself. You talked about receiving a salary before, and I guess mentally that stage from being the three of you to suddenly having to start forking out to pay someone else's salary. Do you remember when that employee number one kind of joined the...
Yeah, I mean, he's called John. You probably met him.
Okay.
He was the first guy at the desk. Yeah. You could see any. Straight out of uni, fresh, green, ready to design the world.
Yeah.
But
from so he was from university in
Jomo Kenyatta University. Okay. Jomo Kenyatta.
Yeah.
Agriculture, yeah. And yeah, he performed really well.
Yeah.
Had a strong design sense.
Okay.
And thought process. Yeah. So we brought him in, and he was the one first guy. But before that, we got Priscilla. She's probably our longest standing employee.
Okay.
She was to help our admin side.
Yeah.
As you probably know, architects are pretty useless in managing running their time, running a business. So
you made the decision fairly early on then to employ someone to help with the administrative side.
Yes,
that's right.
We needed help.
Yeah.
Best to mention even how we started out with John is he would come and would brief him on what to do. Because we didn't have space, he would go home, work on it, and then
come back. Okay.
Yeah.
That's how he started.
So when did you employ him? Do you remember what year that was?
2015.
Fairly soon after starting then. Okay, so fairly quick growth.
Yeah.
And then at what stage did you move here? Yeah, that's the next kind of phase then is. And this is the only office you've had as a practice?
Well, actually, in the same building, we've had a smaller space.
Okay.
And when we had that agreement with the landlord to fit out the space we're in right now, we were in that small unit for about almost a year.
Yeah, a year.
Yeah. And it was getting quite cramped.
Yeah.
And we didn't really thrive in that space, I felt. We were always looking forward to have a space that
you
we can
designed.
Call home.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Because with CAVE and its whole identity, I mean, there's a lot we put on our shoulders in terms of our values and the kind of work we wanted to produce. And the kind of talent we wanted to attract, in our minds, that space was really key.
Yeah.
Mm.
To shape it all out.
Yeah.
Has that all shaped out? No, probably not yet. But you know.
That's interesting about you. I mean, is that what's it? Winston Churchill's line about shaping our buildings and
that's
our buildings shape us, or whatever. It's
that's right.
You were fairly keen that you kind of had fairly strong views about how you wanted your practice space to feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really important for us.
Okay.
Actually.
And then again, is there a kind of challenge? So you were doing that building as you had other projects going on.
Yeah.
There's presumably then a question about how much time you dedicate to projects which are bringing in fees and how much time you want to, I guess the kind of desire is that actually everyone wants to work on the project you're going to be spending time in.
Yeah, we probably spend too much time designing.
That's kind of where I was,
as sinking money in the
that
project.
That we don't have.
Yeah.
And our time, that we didn't have. And it's only in hindsight we realize.
Yeah.
we love the space, but it was too expensive.
It wasn't the wisest thing to do. But yeah, we did it. And you know, that's something we don't have to think about now because we have the office.
Yeah.
And I think it would have actually been harder to have settled in and you have projects that are running and you're still trying to design your space.
That's right.
It wouldn't work.
Yeah, so you've got that out of the way now. It's one less thing to think about.
Yes.
But we were saying then when we were downstairs about it being quite a generous space, that there is space to expand. And you said you're not that keen on expanding and losing, packing more people in and growing. And that's, again, a bold, you know, kind of...
We were actually discussing that today, and we were thinking there's a project that we've been trying to sign with a client, and if we do sign it, we'll actually struggle if we don't hire somebody else.
Right.
But something we discussed is we can actually employ temporary people.
Yeah.
So they're not full-time staff. They just come in for the project, work up to the stage we feel we can now manage it on our own, and they leave.
Yeah.
So that way you only have short stints of many people per se in the office, but you still retain the small
feel.
Core, yeah.
But interestingly enough, with that dynamic, we're always very keen to not so much control who comes into the cave, but be very conscious of the work environment. Because it's taken us really long to develop our chemistry, especially with the younger staff, you know, massaging millennials to get the best out of them is not the easiest thing. So we find getting other people coming temporarily could be problematic, but it's something, you know, as you grow, you know, you need to figure out.
Yeah.
Obviously, we know we don't want to grow too big, but if that means constantly hiring and bringing foreign chromosomes in the building, you know, how does that affect
feel?
Feel of it,
because you've invested so much in your own practice, you want it to, the feel and the identity and the that's quite
A studio is a sensitive thing.
Yeah.
What we've begun to realize, it's because in fact there was a time when we, maybe not so much a fault of our own, we had an incident where we unfortunately had to get rid of an individual.
Right.
And I don't want to go into the details of it, but it completely rocked us. Everyone was taken aback.
Yeah.
Wow. An individual can actually have a huge impact.
In a small team.
In a small
office,
team,
really big. Yeah.
Yeah.
And which could completely permeate through the entire system you've created.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. And I suppose you can take it as a personal investment in a practice. It can be upsetting and destabilizing. And it's one thing, I suppose, when you're talking earlier about letting people go and about the kind of language around that kind of people.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes back to the kind of people in a practice and how... So how do you now then go about hiring staff? I mean, how do you know when you interview that people are going to fit and that?
Usually, it will start with their portfolio.
Yeah.
Mm. Actually, even for the three graduate architects we've got downstairs, it started with a portfolio.
Okay.
We have lots and lots of portfolios.
Yeah.
In the office filed, but there are some that pop out.
Right.
And we are usually interested in those that pop out, and we'll call them for an interview. Mm.
So
and I think, and I'm not being, boastful or anything to say that. I think so far, when we see a portfolio and we feel something about it, when we meet the person, it's usually spot on.
And so you're getting speculative, I guess, the kind of reputation now that you've got to a stage where the practice is known and is talked about. I'm interested then, maybe you've spoken to a few people here about how, you know, certainly in London, there's a community of architects and people talk and people get to know your work. Yeah, how does that, you know, I was talking to another practice earlier on about recognition through awards, and how do people, it's a small number, you know, for the size of country, a small number of registered architects, so there's a lot of people who talk and know each other, and how does the architectural profession here exchange? I mean, is there a kind of trade press? What's the sort of method for people talking about and critiquing each other's work? Does that?
It's not as formalized and developed in the UK. Although we inherited a lot of the systems of how practices are governed by regulations and who is qualified to become an architect, what's educative
protection
stage,
of title and
protection
everything
of title
else.
And blah blah blah. I would say it's very stiff here, which has meant the ability for the profession to show itself and celebrate the work being done has been to some degree stifled.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and I think maybe with the advent of social media, that's begun to loosen it.
Yeah.
Because it's a space that's not, it's almost not regulatable.
Yeah.
sorry, I just invented a word. It's not regulated, and you can't quite regulate it per se.
Yeah.
And that has really given wings.
Yeah.
To a lot of offices and a lot of designers who might just open an Instagram page and very loosely describe who they are.
Yeah.
And you find a lot of people can come through there with inquiries just because maybe they like what they see.
And does that kind of then internationalize a little bit? I mean, I guess the kind of references, and you might previously get to know practices through you know, the Architects Journal or something about what people are doing, but I guess a lot easier now for, I mean, you talked about the collaboration with the Spanish architect. How did they make contact? How did they, was that through social media? Was that?
No, it was, I think it was just, I believe Balmoy knew.
Ah, okay, so there was a personal contact.
It was a personal contact,
But now you must get more inquiries from, you know, internationally in terms of.
Yeah, well, there's one project that Stella is working on right now.
Yeah.
That came through, I mean, Stella will describe it, but in a nutshell, a mass design group approached us to be the local partner, to collaborate on designing a tech campus in Nairobi.
Right.
They're American, with a Rwandese Connect.
Okay.
And so they have projects in Nairobi.
Right.
And so I think they did their own homework and felt that CAVE might be a good fit to collaborate. And it was a general collaboration, because what you find, a lot of projects are fronted by international offices.
Yeah.
And when they're localized, it's only purely to deliver the building, as opposed to
being a part of,
be a part of the design process, which is really key, because we locally have a very fresh understanding and appreciation of what it is to be local and how to localize an architectural intent.
Yeah.
You know?
So someone might come to you with a concept or with a sketch, with an idea, and I guess then for you, you're wanting, if you're going to work in partnership with someone, to work with someone who's not just looking for you to go away and oversee the build.
And we're quite, in fact, we made a very quick decision to make sure that we are not that architect who delivers your project. We need to own the project as well. For us, it brings more meaning for the client and the whole team process.
So we talked then a bit about the future and about size and expanding, and have you thought much else apart from the size of the practice about what else you might? So I know we're talking separately to Balmoy, he's doing some more now still involved in the practice, stepped away to do some more research maybe.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of CAVE then, what's the future? Where are you? Is there a grand plan? Is there a, you're just, yeah, the plan is to enjoy the work.
What's the plan?
Yeah.
It's a good question. I mean, we're just hunter-gathering our way along, to be honest. Nairobi is an extremely challenging environment, but exciting at the same time, you know. We don't want to script it too much. Yeah. We feel scripting a direction of the office can be very problematic for obvious reasons. Yeah. So we wanna grow, wanna evolve, and immerse within Nairobi, just get stuck in, if you'd call it that. Yeah.
Also, in addition to what Kabage is saying, our logo would have CAVE, and then we have architecture, interior, furniture, and landscaping.
Yeah.
So we're not limiting ourselves to just architecture.
Yeah.
We toyed briefly with furniture.
Right.
But obviously, at the time we're doing it, we're also getting a lot of architectural work, so we sort of put it aside for the moment. But actually, we had somebody come in. The sculpture that's in our office is sitting on a tree stump that's been cut. We're meant to be designing it into a coffee table.
Right.
Mm. So, I guess one of the things an architect can do is go into any discipline of design. You can stop architecture and be a fashion designer, a graphic designer, any sort of designer. I think an architect can do that, which is very different from other disciplines of design. A fashion designer can't decide to be an architect.
To build a building.
So that's a good, an advantage of an architect, because you're a designer. And so, you know, in the future, if we find that architecture is not working, we're not maybe going to wind up and say, oh, too bad, let's, you know. We can diversify and look at going into another niche or something.
Okay. And it's something we talk about quite a bit with regards to products. Because we're looking at a CAVE paint. Literally looking at the substrate of CAVE paint originally, which was partly blood. I mean, we don't use blood. Blood, soil.
Blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah, blood, sweat, and tears.
There's a lot of that in the profession. But,
CAVE paint, CAVE soap.
Right.
And the idea is to
it's
sort
a strong
of
brand
go back.
You've got there. Where did the CAVE concept, the CAVE brand, the CAVE idea come from?
It came through a lot of brainstorming.
Yeah.
We homed into CAVE very fast because we felt, for one, being in the so-called cradle of mankind, the origin of man, the CAVE as the original shelter. Architectural piece, architectural space that man encountered, man and woman, it's quite straightforward. The datum is very clear.
Yeah.
And from that, you can spread and move into other space. Yeah. So we reference the CAVE in terms of understanding and questioning what the city has become. Because we look at the city as a bit of a sort of man-made CAVE in different shapes and forms. And a lot of our habits in the CAVE are still apparent in the city. You know, the positive and negative. It became a big repository of, you know, ideas and information
I'm just wondering there, just finally, is there anything about, just we've not really talked about Nairobi as a city, and about, you know, it's kind of, talking a little bit earlier about some of the buildings and the kind of influence of those buildings, just maybe I just to finish off your kind of thoughts about. Some people have talked about whether there's a master plan coming for Nairobi and the kind of the future of the city. You were talking earlier about your first project is master planning. Is there, and then you're obviously working at this kind of range of scales from furniture to master plans. Thoughts about the kind of future of the city, where Nairobi is going and what role architects have got to play in the city.
We have this idea that there's three different categories of, are they of architecture? Not really architecture, but origin made. And
oh yeah, of the city.
Of the city.
Yeah.
Yeah, where we have the origin, we have made, and we have
void.
The void.
Yeah. Okay.
So a lot of our parents' age mates or generation rather, didn't grow up in Nairobi.
Right.
They were from elsewhere, out of Nairobi, but then they came in into Nairobi. So that's the origin, we like to call the origin. So it's the rural urban migration.
Urban, yeah.
And then we have the void. And the void consists of people just really struggling to make it in the city.
Yeah.
And they're struggling to get out into the made. And the made is sort of affluent.
Yeah.
So you're struggling in this space where you're trying to go out into a bigger house, into the leafy suburbs, so to say.
Yeah.
Yet the people who are in the made are trying to go back to the origin because now there's too much.
Right. circular,
going on. So it's just now trying to, even in our projects, we've recently, the intern that Kabage was talking about earlier, is trying to fit our projects within that origin, void and made space.
Yeah.
What is it? And what is it trying to do in terms of these three things?
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And I think to add on to that, our definition of those three spaces was quite important in terms of our practice. Because it's elaborated in our manifesto, a short film we've done, and a small paper we've written. And the whole principle of it is that each of these spaces are quite independent, and they function not very fluidly between each other. So you have very problematic conditions, for example, in the void, where the perception of people living in the void is that it's a dysfunctional space, and not to necessarily be improved, but to be moved out of.
Yeah,
into the mid.
So our whole argument is that each of these spaces need to be interlinked better, need to be appreciated for their characters. Because, for example, you find there are more community interactions within the void than in the made space, which are the gated communities, sort of locked up. And unfortunately, that value system is very problematic in Nairobi, where you're no longer looking forward to be in a space where you're connected to your neighborhood and to your neighbors. So I guess what our projects are trying to do is to partly break those barriers, to connect those spaces much better. And something that we're trying to push as well is public space projects, one we're doing in Dandora. And that's an interesting project where we engage the community to question what public space means to them.
Yeah.
And there's a project called the Floating Zebra, which we've sort of shaped up. And it was developed through a lot of community consultation. And what's nice about it is that the community, through that project, is defining their identity in that space and feeling that public space actually is theirs and their own to shape and mold, to get value out of. So although that's a very small project, we feel it epitomizes what CAVE is and what CAVE is trying to do, to really allow people to value whatever territory they're in and partly be helped to take it to the next level. So I mean, it's how CAVE is trying to engage with that complex ecology within within the city and what interactions are being bypassed and how to reconnect them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if we answered your question.
No, you did answer it. That's really, I think that's really interesting, that kind of compound mentality that people want a secure space and they move out. And
yeah,
it feels maybe slightly American in terms of that car culture, and that you,
that's right,
you from your compound, you get in your car, you drive through a gate, you drive somewhere else through another gate, and the gate closes, and then you're isolated. And
it's still the aspiration of very many people.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
there's so many, I guess, in popular culture, people talking about American LA kind of culture, and people isolated in their cars, and you know, not interacting and not finding public space to meet each other. I mean, that's really,
that's right,
sounds fascinating. So how, just finally then, how can people find it? You talked about your paper, you talked about the video. How can people find that?
Well, we have a website, which is just www.cave.co.ke, where you'd probably get a link into everything we do.
Okay, cave.co.ke.
.co.ke, yeah. .co.ke.
Okay, let me say that again.
Same thing.
Same thing.
Cave.co.
K-E.
K-E, yeah.
Not UK, not UK.
So I've got a wired into me, yeah, okay.
And we have our Instagram and angle,
okay,
which is Cave Bureau.
Okay, Cave Bureau.
Yeah.
Okay, where people can see some of the projects. And,
yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for your time. We've covered a huge amount. It's really fascinating to learn from two different, very different parts of the world, Australia and the UK. You've flown the nest, flown back again.
Yeah.
They're creating some amazing work. Thank you so much. That's
thank
great.
You.
Thank you, Owen.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Kebajay Karanja and Stella Mutegi. You can find out more about Kebajay and Stella and their work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. Music from this episode was from Peter Lagono and Raw Music International, Kisumu Mixtape, via the Free Music Archive and released under a Creative Commons license. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.